The title of the talk today is Party Dress. And I would like to start with a poem, because part of the party is I have some really poems that I really love. And some of them I've had with me for 20 years, and I've never read them to people, even those that I know a long time. So I'm very happy today. This is a poem by someone named Edith Sudergran. On foot, I had to walk through the solar system before I found the first thread of my red dress. Already, I sense myself. Somewhere in space hangs my heart. Sparks fly from it, shaking the air to other reckless hearts. On foot, I had to walk through the solar system before I found the first thread of my red dress. Already, I sense myself. Somewhere in space hangs my heart. Sparks fly from it, shaking the air, shaking the air. Sparks fly from it, shaking the air to other reckless hearts. Thus have I heard once upon a time in the United States, or as one of my Indian friends calls it, the United Snakes of America. There was a woman who was expert in karate, black belt. And she practiced a lot to get to that point of being able to put on the black belt. And very, very terribly, it so happened that one time she was attacked by someone else on the street, not in the studio of the karate training. And she was unable to defend herself. She had a black belt in karate. She could take any of us, or all of us, out. But in the actual street, someone attacked her, and terribly, she was unable to defend herself. And she tried to figure out what had happened, why that was, and she started to find out that the same thing had happened to other women who were very good in karate or other kinds of martial arts, self-defense classes, but actually in the moment when it was needed, unable to do what was needed. And so from that experience, she started a different kind of training just for self-defense for women on the street. Because she realized that what she was practicing in the karate studio, so as not to hurt anyone, so as not to actually kill them or take them out, was she was practicing not to fully extend her movements. So in the studio, she was not actually able to really go with her movements. She was practicing hesitation. She was practicing holding back. And so in the moment that it was needed, she didn't remember terribly how to fully move. You can tell I don't know any karate. So she made it a way that women could actually practice on a living person without hurting the person, but fully from their center, saying no to that violence. And I was able to do a short training in that when I was in college, and It was actually surprisingly fun to practice defending oneself. It seemed very strange, but that fullness of movement. So I'd like for us to just check here, because we're talking about practice all the time. And I'm not sure that we know exactly what practice is. Sometimes using the word too much, we lose track of what we're actually talking about. So practice could be bringing to life, bringing embodiment to a theory or a technique, bringing it to life. Practice, making it practical, not just theoretical. That's what practice could be. And even the statement that probably never helped anyone, practice makes perfect, it might have a secret truth in it. Perfect. If we take the word apart, it means made through, all the way made, fully extended. So if we could check in our practice, if we're practicing hesitation, if we're practicing wholeheartedness, which might be a better word than mindfulness, wholeheartedness, heartfulness, moment to moment. Not because we have a whole hour that we think we've got to sit still here and look meditative. We better save our strength. We better not be fully here yet. We might get tired after a while. And then what would we do? Well, we could be fully tired, heartfully tired. So what I see us usually doing is backwards. We try to get perfect, and we try to pretend that we're perfect. And we hope that there will be this trickle-down effect. We hope that by pretending to be perfect, something will someday happen that we really are, or enough people will believe that we are, then we can also believe, or something like that. So if we can try to see if this is happening, if there's, as Christopher spoke yesterday about the roles that we take on and get stuck into, are we taking some kind of model of perfection and trying to copy that, and then kind of closing our eyes, closing our ears, hoping for the best? Are we dressing up like a meditator? And losing track of our center from which we could have full extension, which is fun, even in self-defense. Sometimes when people practice together, what happens is that we start to look more and more similar over time. Sometimes this happens. Sometimes there's even a uniform that we dress up in order to remind ourselves what we're doing, what's important. And this can be very helpful. But it's also, I think, helpful to keep in mind a story from the controversial teacher Bhagwan Rajneesh, who had a lot of intelligence in some of the ways that he taught, some of them. So for a while, he had his students wearing the same color. They all had to wear the same color. And then from one day to the next, from tomorrow on, you can wear anything you want. You don't have to wear the same color anymore. So of course, there was a big party the next day, and everyone wearing everything but that color they had to wear before. And Rajneesh made his point. He said, I'm very disappointed that before you only wore the color because you thought you had to. not because from your center it felt appropriate, not because out of your love you did so. That was the end of that party. Just noticing how we do that. It can be very easy in the Sarnath program, especially since we're able to talk so much. You start to hear yourself saying the words like, a thought was arising. And you start to say it more and more frequently. It starts to take over. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Anger was arising. The I was arising. And you've never spoken that way in your life before. And suddenly you can't stop yourself. Sometimes it's a language that's helpful and it feels appropriate. And sometimes it's just the easiest choice because that's what everyone else is doing. Everyone else is wearing the same color. Other times, in a movement that seems to be different but is not so different, we want to express ourselves. We want to wear what expresses us. We will not wear what we feel is not me. We feel uncomfortable if a friend gives us a gift that we think we should wear, but it's not me. The love is not strong enough to just wear it. So we're dressing up as some character, which is usually cool or smart or profound. So we wear our problems. If you've noticed, sometimes in order to have a deep conversation, the subject must be problems. It's like a symbol of deep. We had a really deep conversation about our problems. And it's definitely important that there's space for people to speak about what moves them to speak. I'm not saying, now, everyone, don't talk about your problems. Not at all. In fact, the opposite, as we'll see later. What would be deeper than problems? This has been something coming up over the days as a question. What's deeper than our problems? I think it's important to see if we're really caught up like everybody else in the room, by the way, who are really caught up in constantly trying to figure out if we fit in, if our superficial layer fits in with the scene. We're constantly assessing, constantly checking. And I think this is one of the main reasons that there's hesitation in our practice, that there's not full extension. Now. So now in the listening. Not full extension, because checking. Does this fit what I knew from before? Did I know this yet? Oh my God, I didn't know that. Oh, I already knew that. It's shaking us. We're shaking ourselves all the time. Not letting ourselves come into the center from where there could be full extended movement. I think it's important to notice how much of that goes on. Checking, assessing, have I gotten anywhere yet? Am I somebody yet? Am I meditating yet? Without knowing what meditation is, we want to know if I'm meditating. What could take us deeper? First, and then from there, let all the questions blossom. There will be an abundance of questions, a mess of questions. I would like to suggest what I see us doing, what I think seems to be behind our getting trapped in the superficial, in the assessing and showing, checking so often that we don't have any time left to actually be here. What I think is behind is, first of all, very, very deep, but not the deepest place. Very, very deep, we want love. Very, very simply. That goes together with feeling, maybe I'm not quite part of life. Maybe I'm not going to get love. And that starts to become, I want to be loved. I want love. I better get love. How am I going to get love? And so we have our, all of us, our ways that we try. Wanting approval, wanting to do it right, fears about failure, wanting to get that experience, that understanding, wanting people to like me. And then the opposite strategies, proving that actually I can't get love. I was right. Making distance between me and other people. So for some of you, you have already noticed this, and in this lovely thing that happens in Sarnath and other retreats, as I'm writing the notes for this talk, you're writing me notes about the same subject, and it's coming in the groups. And as usual, Christopher gave the same talk yesterday, in just different language. So it's just coming somehow, coming through. So I had a note the other day where someone said, what is this that happens to me where I'm so demanding? Is it just wanting love? So no need even for interview. Yes, love, Jaya. I think that we get tangled up in a particular place in our experience. I think that we have this big confusion going on. Starting from the feeling that maybe I'm not really life. Maybe I'm not really part of this party of life. And then we start to check too much. So if there's pain, failure, criticism, any hint of death in the air, I think it's some kind of punishment, and I take it symbolically non-love. If I feel a little bit of pain in the body, if I feel emotional pain, I take it personally, a punishment. Removal from love. This is not true. It never was true. We don't stop to find out if it's true. We just keep running. And if there's pleasure, if we have an up day, if someone gives us a compliment, says something good about us, or something we've done, or if we feel we're young, strong, healthy. What a trap. This is symbolically love in our tangled wires. What I would suggest is going to that one place that you may have never gone, the one place you would not like to go to, the one place that you think is the core of who you are and the worst place in the universe, the one place that is shaking you, and that is that wanting love. go to it. And just pause for a moment, see what it looks like from outside, and then go inside it. Get close to that wanting love. It might take you a week to trace through what I'm saying. If you can't quite do it right now, it's okay. Trying to feel the wanting love. And once you enter into it, from outside, as someone said today, it seems insatiable, which means could never be filled. There could never be enough love for that wanting. It feels like from outside. But luckily, at least, we have this wanting love. Sometimes it's the only opening in our whole being. Sometimes it's the only way in. Maybe it is the only way in. Go into it and see what happens. Going into it, there's a falling into love. Not more being loved, loving, just a falling into love. Falling into a place where love already is. It's already going on. The party is waiting for you. It's not waiting for you. It's going on. Come anytime. Come as you are. We had these parties when I was a child. And the friends would call you when they knew you'd already gotten into bed and were ready for sleep. And it was called the Come As You Are party. And you were supposed to come to the party that weekend in whatever you were wearing when you answered the phone. Which some people couldn't legally do. And probably many people made a few adjustments before showing up. What would it be like just to show up now in your own life? As you are. There's a piece that I want to say that feels difficult to express, and it's still worth saying, I feel. Forgive me if I can't say it well. Part of this tangle in interpreting pain as non-love, as being kicked out of life, and interpreting pleasure as being accepted, as being part of life, as being allowed to be loved. Part of this tangle is has something to do with our fear, a fear that makes us be more ready to be obsessed with our problem than to want to look at the cause of the problem. So I have two examples of this, and just see if something comes across. If not, never mind. When I was in college and had started meditating about 9 months before, a couple of hours a day and a few retreats here and there, it so happens that as we start to tune into something under the surface of our lives, something deeper, it so happens that sometimes the surface gets messier. And in my case, that definitely happened. That was definitely the messiest year of my life. And I was dealing with memories of sexual abuse in my childhood. And all of my friends happened to be out of the country, and so I was really alone. And a mess. Couldn't sleep, couldn't get up when I used to be able to get up early morning, no problem, etc. Just a mess. And after slowly finding people to help and coming to a place where things were getting a little better, I still found myself, okay, fewer terrible, violent dreams about the end of the world, but still a lot of panic at night, as soon as it got dark. And I remember having enough calm eventually, after probably about 6 or 9 months of being a mess, of knowing what a mess I was. And I was lying in bed, trying to go to sleep, and the house that I stayed in was right on a busy road next to a parking lot in a big city in the States. And I was terrified that some person was going to climb the wall and come in the window and attack me from the dark parking lot. Perfect scene from a movie. And I was lying there and trying to stay with the calmness and see what's happening. Why is this terror taking me? And some shift kind of happened where I suddenly realized, if someone would climb the house and come into the window, through the window and attack me, it wouldn't be my fault. There would be nothing I could have done. And then I could sleep. Very strange. And today someone in one of the discussion groups mentioned a related example that might help clarify what I'm trying to say. She said that when she's in Israel, as we all have heard on the news, there are frequent bomb attacks, people being killed, injured, etc. So she is aware that anytime she goes out, anytime she stays in, anytime at all, she could be killed. And she notices that she's not afraid. Wish this were the case for all of us. First of all, knowing we could die at any time. Second of all, walking around not being afraid of that. A real threat. And she said, I'm more interested in why I'm not afraid than I am in being afraid. She's less interested in being afraid of dying, real possibility every time she goes out. She's more interested in finding out why she's not afraid. I would suggest that there's something in here where we just notice that life is made of death, life, pain, pleasure, success, failure. People like us, people don't like us, people don't notice us. People project onto us and they like their projection, they don't like their projection. That's what's happening. So then what? It's not our fault that we're going to die. But we are going to die. So what's life about? Does that make sense at all? A couple more poems. One, I hope, will surprise you what it has to do with practice, what it has to do with a different way. It was written by someone in the 8th century, the 8th century before the Common Era. So a long time ago, almost 3,000 years ago, almost. I wish I were close to you, as the wet skirt of the salt woman to her body. whoa, as Christian would say, whoa, like this, whoa. So in case the English is difficult, there's a woman harvesting salt in the sea. So she's probably getting wet from her work. I wish I were close to you, as the wet skirt of the salt woman to her body. This was probably a love poem to a person. It could be a love poem to our life. I wish I were close to you, as the wet skirt of a salt woman to her body. Loving life that much, see what happens. How big your life gets. Going through the tiny opening, wanting love. Even the worst, cruelest people in the world, I feel, want love. And their way of trying to strategize, trying to get that, is more deranged, more insane than ours. Matter of degree. Not totally different. But there is this opening that we could, this soft spot, as one of my teachers said. Coming through loving life that much to find out what's been driving us away from ourselves, making us run away. Falling into our life, falling into our love. Finding the first thread of our red dress. What seems to happen is we're less preoccupied, we're less worried about how we appear to others. We're less willing to take in pain or criticism or failure as a symbol of not love, not life. You're out. It's not the criticism that hurts, it's the way we swallow it, the way we take it in. There's no failure except the way we take it in. There's no death except the way we swallow it. Wanting to be that close to our life, to truth, to what's going on underground, does have a cost. It does mean that the surface is no longer so ordered. It's no longer following rules so well. So I finally get to read to you the poem, which I have to explain and read again, so slowly, slowly, slowly. The image is of a kind of cloth that's printed with a particular design, and the cloth is called Michinoku cloth, as far as my notes say. Is that a word? Like Michinoku cloth, printed with tangled ferns, kind of plant, my mind is disordered because of you, but my love is not. Like Michinoku cloth, printed with tangled ferns, my mind is disordered because of you, but my love is not. So once we're willing to accept the cost of a disordered mind a disordered surface. We find that the love is not disordered. What's underlying and allowing everything? It's not ordered. It's not disordered. It is as it is. If we're willing to pay the cost, that means even giving up goodness. Goodness is a great way to get people to like you and to use you and to try to get somewhere that you think is going to be love and never is, trying to be good. Can we trust our life enough to give up the rules about goodness and find out, what is this cloth? What comes up? If we could possibly be more interested in nothing, more interested in nothing than in something, and see what comes through. It's difficult. I noticed that the silent day, when there seems to be nothing happening, is the day that people go to Varanasi to find a lot of something. Too much of something, and too much of something else too. Isn't it? It's the day that I'll take as my day off. It's just the silent day. Going through this wanting love into our life, into what supports and allows everything to happen, we're moved in a different way. There's full extension. But it's easy to want to go back to where we knew the rules and could follow them. Isn't it? So many people have described their experience here, I think especially here, because there's not the one technique that's being offered that everyone is doing. There's highlighting of a diversity of us. So many people saying, I've let go of the old ways. Someone said, I feel upside down. It can feel like we're upside down because our interest has gone underneath. We can feel completely confused, full of doubt, so many questions, no idea how I'm going to respond, how I'm going to act, what I'm going to say from nothing. And it's easy to just go back to the rules. Go back to say, oh, look at all these tangled ferns. Let's put them in order. And then we've lost our only hope, our only way into our life, which is our life. Not dressing up as someone else. It takes tremendous, huge, gigantic trust. It takes more trust than you have. You don't have to have that much trust. But giving up, at least, the old. Being willing to be confused. The confusion and the question will leave you. And there can be different kinds of disorder when we've become loyal to the love And we've agreed that we are a mess. We are not our life and our nose and our ears and our digestive system and our brain don't follow the rules. When we agreed that, we're not like anyone else. And at the same time, everything that we are is borrowed. My father's nose, my mother's ears, my grandmother's hair. So we can see that we could be ourselves, that we have a little bit of trust in life, a little bit of trust in ourselves, and let's just borrow the rest of the trust that we need. We've borrowed everything else. We borrowed the calcium and the iron and the water. And sometimes we give some of it back. Just to keep steady with what's important underlying the disorder and the seeming disorder. Sometimes there's a period of transition. We feel upside down. Our interest has gone from surface to depth. Our loyalty, not just our interest, our center of gravity has gone from the surface to the depth, deeper than the problems. Whose problems are they anyway? Did you make them with your hands? Where that problem is coming out of, where that problem is borrowing energy from, that anger, that fear, that loneliness. And there can be a time that it's extra messy when we first shift our center of gravity to the depth. So there was a woman who was amazingly quick in meditation, Deepa Ma. I mentioned her in Bodh Gaya as well. And as she was going deeper, even her health became really, really worse. She was having heart trouble. She had to crawl up to the meditation hall. And then there was an insight, very, very deep one, strong connection to the depth, lasting connection to the depth. And her heart was fine. She was upright, cheerful, no more depression. Reversal of the aging process. From one moment to the next. We're not always that lucky. Sometimes it's just like if you're sitting in meditation, the leg falls asleep. So that would be like an imposed rule or order that our living organism is not quite necessarily at ease with. And when we let the circulation come back into the leg, it's painful. It's life coming back in. But it feels like sickness. It feels terrible. So it's good to know that on the way to love, you can feel that you're worse than before. You can seem to be worse than before. But the best part is that it's not so important anymore. It's not the important thing. And what maybe before looked like disorder, looked like a problem, confusion, from the loving eyes is absolutely no problem, is in fact graceful, so alive. And we lose our fear that we might get dirty if we touch the surface stuff. Ooh, superficial. Yuck. But falling into our life, falling into love, and being moved from there, everything seems to be possible. And I just tell a short story of one of my teachers and this subject. So his name was Punjaji, and I called him Papaji, grandfather. Papaji was with his teacher, had finally found his teacher, and was spending as much time as possible with his teacher, because everything else was an illusion. And one day, walking with his teacher on the mountain there, another friend walking with them said to my teacher's teacher, "Hey, did you know that Punjaji has family?" This is 1947, partition of India. Punjaji has family in what's going to become Pakistan. Some of you might not be aware of what that means. It means that his family would have a very good chance of being killed for being Hindus in what was going to be Pakistan. And Punjaji was hanging out with his teacher in South India, about as far away from Pakistan as he could be. And Papaji said, "Yes, my family is an illusion to me. You, my teacher, are my only family now." Doesn't that sound great? Doesn't that sound pure? You, my teacher, it's so romantically spiritual. You are my only family now. And my teacher's teacher said to him, "If this is all illusion, what stops you? What stops you from going there to Pakistan to get your family out before it's too late?" Papaji turned around, took a little bit of dust from under the feet of his teacher, left, and never saw his teacher again. Went to Pakistan at great risk to his own life, and brought about 40 family members, most of them women, to Lucknow, where I still live. One little part of the story. At one point, Papaji had gone, every time taking a train to Pakistan or out of Pakistan, good chance of being not just killed, but tortured, burned, chopped into pieces. He got to Pakistan, got many of his family onto a plane through some army connections, and came back alone on the train. He was a big wrestler. He had tattoos. One of them was an Om, Hindu symbol. He had the gold earrings of a Brahmin in his ears. And on that train, he got into the Muslim compartment because he was standing on the platform and he heard a voice inside him that said, "That compartment, the Muslim one." No one noticed him. This is like at least 24-hour train ride. He's the only Hindu in a group of Muslims, high tension. No one noticed him. And terribly, the whole Hindu car, everyone killed on that train ride. It's not that there's no risk. There is not a guarantee. Being moved from love, not afraid to get into the disorder from love. In fact, nothing can stop us. Being moved from below by love. There's no reason not to get even messier than we already are. No reason not to. full extension, no reason to hold back, and no guarantee. Like trusting life to dress us for the party. We might not like what we're wearing on a particular day. We might not like what's happening on the surface today. Because of love, we just wear it. Not half wearing. Come as you are, party. True perfection seems imperfect, yet it is perfectly itself. May the energy of our being here fully, of our listening and reflecting fully, of our loving life fully, be a revolution towards peace on the planet and awakening in all of the reckless hearts.